Welcome to this week's Key Voices. I'm Adam Wainwright, bringing you a roundup of the latest education news and a summary of the year gone and a look to the year ahead, which I'll be bringing you with my colleague, Kayleigh Foran. Firstly, the news headlines this week. Gavin Williamson has been named as the new Education Secretary by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Damien Hines has now left the DfE and returned to the backbenchers, ending a tenure of 18 months. His successor is the fifth Education Secretary in the space of a little over 5 years. A survey of teachers' wellbeing conducted by Ofsted found that inspections themselves are a major source of workload and stress for teachers in England. The survey of more than 2,000 school and college staff revealed that teachers put in longer hours than many others in the UK workforce, reporting that they worked more than 50 hours a week on average. Schools and colleges in England need a multi-billion pound cash injection and a long-term approach to funding, say MPs on the Education Select Committee. Its report on school funding confirms the concerns of headteachers and teachers' unions who have protested about worsening budget shortages. Also this week, the TES has reported on research which showed that teachers are under huge pressure to respond immediately to incessant emails from parents asking about their child's schooling. The head of Ofsted has called for an end to what she described as an instant response culture and urged both management and parents to support teachers in their efforts to do a good job in the classroom. New Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said he will immediately begin to work to level up per-pupil funding for schools. Delivering his first speech on the steps of Downing Street, Johnson said that it's his job to make sure children get a superb education wherever they are. And now onto our interview series. This week, Kayleigh and I will be reviewing the past academic year and discussing some of the future developments that we know are coming and some more speculative guesses at what we reckon is going to happen. So welcome to Kayleigh.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for having me.
We are very excited to be reviewing the year just gone. It's been a really, really sentimental trip down memory lane for us both.
Yes, it has. Lots of big announcements this year. So lots to cover.
Yes. Where should we start? Shall we talk about Ofsted? Because that's usually the first.
I think you have to start with Ofsted. It's the biggest, it's by far the biggest change that's affected the sector this year. And it hasn't even come into effect yet. So imagine what it's going to be like come September.
Yeah. So for those who have been living under an education rock for the last year, and for some reason listening to this, Ofsted have announced that they will be bringing in a new framework from September 2019, which is very exciting because it's the first new framework since 2015.
It is the first new framework we've had in quite a few years, and it's a really interesting one because actually there's a lot of support for the things that the framework will be focusing on from the sector. I think that by and large, schools are really excited to see less of a focus on data points and exam results and more of a focus on the actual substance of education, which is what your curriculum is, what it looks like, and why, what you want your kids to achieve by the time they leave your school.
Yeah, I think the sort of combined quality of education judgment that they're bringing in, and generally, yeah, the sort of refocus on the curriculum. Like, I might be proven wrong on this, but it does seem like a fairly popular step. And I think Ofsted did, you know, to their credit, make an effort to learn from the 2015 curriculum and put some resource into speaking to head teachers and speaking to other school leaders and governors about what they did want to see. So, like, hopefully, you know, obviously any new framework might have teething problems, but hopefully it'll be a positive step, and you know.
I think so, and I think the thing to point out is that head teachers obviously are really passionate about the curriculums that their schools deliver, and as a result, this framework in a sense plays to their strengths because it gives them the opportunity to talk about the thing that they're most passionate about, which is the things that their kids learn in their time at the school. And you would expect there to be a lot of warm feeling in the sector for things like that. And I think that the sector has also broadly welcomed the fact that with less of an emphasis on inspectors trawling through internal assessment data and a very clear expectation from Ofsted that where you're collecting internal assessment data, it has to be purposeful and well used, and you have to have a really clear argument for why you're putting this workload on teachers. that there's evidence that Ofsted is taking in all of the things they're hearing from the sector about workload levels being unsustainable and well-being being a challenge as a result of that. So I think those are both really positive developments.
And yeah, I think in a post-national curriculum levels world, assessment's been such a workload driver that hopefully the, you know, reduced focus on internal data is going to be a real step in the right direction. And that's it on Ofsted in a nutshell. Hopefully our positivity will come to light in September onwards and we won't just be being needlessly optimistic. So what else has changed this year? Again, another announcement that's sort of made but yet to come into effect is relationships and sex education reform.
Yes, relationships and sex education reform has probably almost gotten as much media coverage as Ofsted, probably, because it's the sort of thing you've probably been hearing a lot about in the news. Parents have been quite vocal in certain parts of the country about this. Relationships and sex education is obviously nothing new in and of itself. There's been a version of this that has previously been called sex and relationships education that schools have been delivering some part of for some time. The big changes are obviously the emphasis on relationships first rather than sex first. But also there's the new RSE guidance has a lot more, it's formalized the expectations around what you should be teaching to pupils and when. And for a lot of schools, this isn't going to be really new because they'll have been delivering parts of this as part of their PSHE curriculum for a really long time. But now it's formal, and for primary schools, teaching relationships and health education is no longer an option. It's a statutory requirement, or it will be from September 2020. We've seen a lot of interest in this from members because even though September 2020 may feel like it's a really long way off, one of the things that the guidance requires is that you consult with parents when you change your RSE curriculum or your RSE policy. And because you're likely to be making some tweaks to one or both of those things, you have to enter into this consultation process, which is really time consuming. So we know that schools are starting to look at this now ahead of September 2020.
Yeah, quite right. And I think, as you say, I mean, this reform, whilst not necessarily an entire overhaul, like, the current guidance is from 2000. Like,
yeah,
this
2000.
This was a long time coming. And yeah, I think with hopefully enough time to consult with parents, and obviously this, I mean, everyone I speak to who doesn't work in education sort of says this can only be a positive thing. They remember how bad sex education was when they were at school. Like, everyone has a different horror story of hell.
Hey, well, you're speaking to an American whose bad sex education can top your bad sex education any day of the week, I can promise you. But I think it's very much that the public realizes that relationships and sex education for the modern world is important. I think that there's been some question from parents about what it's appropriate for the schools to teach and the when, where, why, and how. But actually what the new guidance does quite smartly, I think, and in recognition of the fact that there will be those sensitivities, is give schools the opportunity to craft a relationships and sex education curriculum that is sensitive to the context of their pupils. What you would teach about, for instance, consent to pupils at different ages is going to be very different, or if your pupils have special educational needs and where they are in age doesn't necessarily match where they are in maturity or development. So all of these considerations need to be taken on board, and I think the guidance recognizes that. And part of what's great about going through this whole consultation process with your pupils and your parents and other stakeholders is making it clear to them that you as a school understand all of those concerns and you're thinking about them and you're not ignoring any of that stuff. So another thing that's a big change that's been announced this year, although it doesn't come into effect quite yet, is changes to assessment in primary schools changes to the reception baseline and the year four multiplication tables check.
Yeah. Well, do you want to start? I mean, obviously, both of us are cup runneth over with opinions about the reception baseline and year four times tables. So I'm more than willing for you to kick us off.
I think the year four times tables multiplication check, they ran a pilot of this this year, and it was interesting because I think the format of the check is really simple. 25 questions on a computer screen where pupils are basically just tested on simple multiplication problems. The idea is that they will know their multiplication table so well by the time they get to the check that it will be almost like a memory exercise more than anything else. There was some mixed feedback, I think, from the pilot. Some schools found the format to be slightly confusing or flustering for kids. But I think overall, this is going to be a check that doesn't increase the assessment burden hugely.
You would hope.
It's the check is very, the amount of time it takes is very short. Preparation time is minimal. Resource time is minimal. You don't need, like you might with SATs, there aren't lots of different access arrangements that you might have to provide for and arrange invigilators in a bunch of different rooms. We know that administering the SATs can be a logistical nightmare. And this doesn't seem like it will have that same issue. But you can certainly make the argument that another check during primary school, in addition to like the key stage two SATs and the year one phonics screening check and things like that, this is a lot of statutory assessment for young kids potentially.
Well, it speaks to a wider, whenever assessment comes up, particularly say in primary school, like it does speak to the wider sort of philosophical debate on how much you should test kids and at what age and how, how aware they are that they're being tested and the effect that has on them psychologically. Like it's a contentious issue, one of which everyone, not just in education, but anyone you speak to has an opinion on testing kids and the right way of going about it. And like, fair enough, like it's an important issue, as you say, hopefully the administration side of it. And all cards on the table, I didn't know a lot about the year four multiplication check because I think I was off when it got announced. And so reading up on it today, the thing that struck me administration-wise, so it's 25 questions.
Yep.
It's 6 seconds per question on screen. Like, that just sounds like something that men in suits do on the tube on the way to work. Like, I think I've seen people playing this game on their
brain
phones,
games,
right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this wouldn't be an issue if it wasn't year fours. Like, this just seems like the sort of thing that, I see people doing on their iPhone. Like,
it seems, and I think the philosophy behind the check, I think, is very much that in order to progress in your maths skills, you need to have a really secure understanding of your times tables, because the times tables are the foundation for a lot of other maths going forward. And so there's certainly a logic there. But I don't think the government's been very clear about what the accountability will look like for this, and as a result it feels very much like or to some within the sector, I think it feels very much like, the goal is great, but is an assessment necessary? And if an assessment is necessary, the accountability attached to that assessment has to be really clear, and I'm not sure that the accountability attached is very clear. So it'll be interesting to see once they roll this out across the country, how it starts to affect teaching and learning and accountability in primary schools, and how we start to use this data. The reception baseline.
A very smooth segue into something where we do know what the accountability implications are.
Yes. The reception baseline is going to be introduced from 2020 as a way, ultimately, of replacing or phasing out Key Stage 1 SATs. The idea is that rather than having Key Stage 1 SATs and then Key Stage 2 SATs on which accountability for primary schools is based. You would have a reception baseline and then your key stage two sats, and progress would be measured between those two points without that key stage one stop in the middle. Obviously, the key stage one sats will hang around for a bit after the reception baseline is introduced. But ultimately, it seems to be a way of not lessening the assessment load, but readjusting the assessment load.
It's lessening it if you teach key stage one and not EYFS.
Well, this is true.
It's, yeah, and then say like 2027, I think, is the first year where a cohort of kids who got assessed on the reception baseline actually reached the end of key stage two. So like, this stuff takes a while for them to go through an entire like primary school cohort. If you are checking the year and wondering why we're talking about the reception baseline in 2019, you may remember it from 2016. It is different now.
Yes.
Like, from, again, from what I recall back in 2016, because I can't remember what happened last week, let alone 3 years ago, there were like three different options for doing the assessment.
Yeah.
And providers would pick an option to assess. And that only lasted a year. And like, I don't think implementation went smoothly. This time around, it's not like that. It's an opt-in pilot next year, though, right? Starting in September in 2019. So schools can opt in if they want. And then 2020, all assuming the pilot, you know, doesn't crash and burn, that's when it'll become statutory.
I was going to say, should we... That kind of leads us quite nicely on to wider, the wider sort of accountability picture, and the announcements the government has made about the floor standard and the coasting schools measure.
Yeah, the floor standards and the coasting measure this year were removed, or sort of, again, halfway house of being removed this year. They were not used in any sort of like intervention for underperforming schools this year, and it was announced that they were getting rid of them, RIP, particularly to the coasting measure, which has only just been in place. Again, was that 2015, 2016? Like, and as a 3 year measure, like, it's only really been around for three consistent years.
Yeah.
And now it's gone again. But I think, again, hopefully not too controversially, Ofsted requires improvement grade will be used as the judgment for, you know, whether schools will be accessed as, oh, sorry, identified as, you know, eligible for support. And crucially, again, like, one of the things, even as someone who, you know, read a lot about floor standards and coasting measure when they were introduced, I think what happens when you fall below the floor or when you're identified as coasting, the options for what it means to be eligible for intervention were always a little bit unclear. And one of the things that actually now is very clear is what happens. So if you get an Ofsted requires improvement judgment, it's if you're in tier one, then you get 3 days of support from a national leader of education. If you're in tier two, which means you've had two RI judgments in a row, you get that plus £16,000 or up to £16,000 support for whatever the NLE recommends that, you know, you do to support your improvement. And that's a lot more straightforward. The fact that I could say that in three sentences then rather than like 20 means that like it's at the very least simplified. Again, like, accountability is a contentious issue, and how you support or challenge or punish schools for underperformance always sort of brings certain emotions to the surface, but like, this is simpler.
I think there's definitely something in this about the fear of the unknown or the fear of the unclear. Like, if you're not sure what being identified as coasting or falling below the floor means for you, it's much easier to build an unsustainable level of stress around that thing. I think the fact that it's quite clear that this is very simple, it's related to your Ofsted grade, and these are the types of support that you can get, will probably mean that this lands better with schools. You know, I think there was always a lot of uncertainty around the coasting schools measure in particular, because, and I definitely see this from a governor perspective, we wouldn't expect to see our schools' outcomes consistently rise, because you get different cohorts of pupils in.
Exactly.
It really affects what your outcomes are. And as a result, this idea that if you're not consistently improving, you're coasting and that's somehow bad, I think just didn't really fit with what school leaders know is true of, you know, teaching children who are indeed human beings who should be treated like that. And they're not, they're not there to pump out a, 75%, expected, meeting the expected standard or whatever. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, this is partly speculative. We'll see how it works from September. See, in terms of the government's capacity to carry this out, like, you know, we'll see how many schools get required improvement judgments, fall into tier one, tier two, like how it works in practice. But yeah, hopefully no one will be shedding too many tears for the removal of the floor standards and the coasting measure. I have no good segue for the next one, but the last thing on our list for our top five was the Timpson Review on School Exclusions.
Yes. So the Timpson Review on School Exclusions is really interesting. And that's not a sentence I ever thought I'd say. So what the review did was it looked at exclusion practice, and it was trying to understand what currently happens in schools, but also to understand why some groups of pupils are more likely to be excluded than others. And as a result of all of the work that the review did, a report was published, and the government committed to basically four things on the back of that report. So they committed to providing support for head teachers to help them maintain safe and orderly environments, support for schools as a whole so that they can put effective interventions in place to prevent exclusions from happening in the first place. They've committed to providing greater clarity about when and how it's appropriate for pupils to be removed from school, and making sure that there's enough oversight of pupils who do move around the education system. So maybe move from a mainstream school to a special school, or a mainstream school to an alternative provision, or something like this. And then the last one is they've committed to providing support for schools and alternative provision providers so that excluded pupils can receive high quality education. And that's all great, you may say, but how do they plan on making that happen? So they've promised a number of changes, and some of those are things like increased support for alternative provision providers. It's not clear what this will look like quite yet. They're hoping to work with Ofsted to tackle off-rolling. Off-rolling is where you sort of encourage a child to leave the school when it's not really the best thing for them necessarily, but it is the best thing for you. They are going to update the exclusions guidance, which I think will be really helpful for schools. I think there's a lot of what the exclusions guidance does well is provide clarity on the process and who you should be working with. But what it doesn't do very well is provide you some sort of benchmark on things like when you might exclude versus when other sanctions might be appropriate, or when a permanent exclusion is appropriate versus a fixed term exclusion, things like that. Some more guidance on what good looks like for schools. They are hoping to encourage more effective partnerships between schools and local authorities. And then they are looking to make schools accountable for the outcomes of permanently excluded pupils, which may seem counterintuitive because you're thinking, as a school, why is it good for me to be accountable for a child who's no longer on my roll? But
it's a historical criticism of like the performance table system though, right? Like the idea that you can game the system by, you know, having less desirable results be moved on.
Yes.
Like it will tackle that.
Yeah, but it also, you know, it does place more accountability on schools, but it's the right thing for pupils.
Yeah.
And pupils should absolutely someone should be accountable for that child's outcomes. And if you've permanently excluded them, whether, you know, for a behavior thing or, you know, whatever it is, there should be someone looking after what their outcomes are ultimately.
And you don't want to, as you say, you don't want to punish schools, but I mean, the priority is making sure that someone is accountable for those pupils. And if, you know, you're worried about the strictness of the accountability system on schools, you reform that accountability system more broadly and what it means to be held to account for these results. Like, you don't lessen the number of pupils who they're accountable for, and you don't, you know, hope that pupils might slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
There are other ways of dealing with the harsh accountability stresses that schools may face.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, as the report points out, the children that suffer most from those kinds of perverse incentives, as it were, are the children that can least afford to suffer. It's the most disadvantaged in our society, the kids that already have a lot of structural barriers in their way. And as a result, those are the kids that need the most help and the most support. And there needs to be the most scrutiny around what they ultimately achieve. We're expecting more consultations and reviews about specific recommendations included in the report. So there will likely be much more news around this and a lot more development in the coming year. But I think it's all going to be a good thing.
Yeah. So onto our speculative and less speculative predictions for 2019-2020. So I know one of the things that you want to talk about, Kaylee, was the role of a mental health lead in schools.
Yeah. So the government has published a whole report looking at ways that they can improve health and well-being outcomes for children and young people. And one of the key recommendations that came out of that report was this idea of a designated mental health lead within a school. It's not a statutory role. So it's not like a special educational needs coordinator or a designated safeguarding lead. But the idea is that you would have someone in the school who looks strategically across the school at how they're supporting mental health and well-being. And that's not just for pupils, that's also for staff. And they are, the government has kind of suggested that the role would involve things like oversight of how policies are implemented and how workload and well-being and mental health is reflected in the curriculum and the pastoral support that the school offers. Someone in the school who understands really well what local mental health services and provision looks like, so that if someone comes to them with an issue or they identify a child who might be at risk, then they know what services and support is available. And someone who can help staff understand issues, raise awareness, support mental health better in their classrooms, support their own mental health better, and just generally kind of coordinating mental health needs for staff and pupils across the school. This is all just like a recommendation, and schools are kind of free to have this role look however they want it to look. But I think it'll be one of the really interesting things to look for in the coming year will be how schools take this and run with it. The government's aiming to provide training for every mental health lead in a school by 2025. They don't know how they're going to do this yet. They're working on it. But I think, you know, this role could look like so many different things. And I think it'll be interesting to see how schools approach this and what emerges as the common themes there. So in addition to the mental health lead role, there's a couple of other things that we anticipate will be quite important in the coming year. And one of those actually, or two of those, relate to Ofsted.
Yes. So as we sort of discussed earlier, there's the new framework coming, but in addition to that, Ofsted have been making some noises intermittently about their role with multi-academy trusts. So over the course of the last year, they announced these new summary evaluations, which are similar approaches to inspection of multi-academy trusts as organisations rather than just the schools within them, which was fairly uncontroversial because that's what they were doing anyway. Summary evaluation is just a sort of new name for them. But they've been talking about the inspection of multi-academy trusts and the fact that they think they should be allowed to do it. The Department for Education disagrees with them, seemingly, about their role. Like, it follows, you know, they don't want to do it for the sake of it. I think you can't really treat MATs as an entirely independent thing to the schools that make them up, because if you took the schools out, the MATs just
a HR director and a CEO and an accounting officer and whatnot. So you can understand what Ofsted are saying, like the two are inextricably linked and they really need to extend their remit to be able to fully inspect and understand the trust that is overseeing the schools they're inspecting. But this would require significant changes to the legislation underpinning inspection and their approach, probably the number of inspectors they have, like the capacity, the format of inspections, and the DfE don't seem to think that Ofsted are the best body to inspect trusts and at trust level. Whether or not that will change in 2019-20 remains to be seen. But like Ofsted are making noises about still wanting to do it.
Yeah, and it's quite, I think it's noteworthy just how insistent Ofsted have been that they think that they're the right people to do this and that this is a power they should have. I think the chief inspector has been quite vocal about this. And she's also been quite vocal about the outstanding schools exemption. At the moment, if you are rated outstanding, you're exempt from regular inspection unless Ofsted's risk assessment procedure suggests that something's going wrong and they need to check up on you. Or indeed, if there's something like a safeguarding report or something like this. And at the moment, the reason it seems that Ofsted is saying this is because the data that they have suggests that the percentage of outstanding schools who are inspected and keep their outstanding rating is actually very small. And that suggests that going 10 years between one inspection and the next is not really good for the schools or good for the pupils in them. And they would like that exemption removed. And again, when they pushed on this and initially, the DfE came back and said, well, no, just have a more robust risk assessment procedure. And they have, the chief inspector has again called for this exemption to go. So it'll be interesting to see once this new inspection framework beds in over the next year or so, whether there's some additional movement that comes on MATs or outstanding schools.
I don't know how much it's like a practical issue. Like the exemption for outstanding schools is like written into legislation. It's not like, it's not just the DfE's advice that they can just change, but like, you know, legislation gets amended. I still think the outstanding exemption and the inspection of MATs, like Ofsted, don't seem to be quietening down anytime soon. No. So that could be a change for next year, but we will wait and see.
Another thing related to multi-academy trusts is this new growth fund.
Yes, the Trust Capacity Fund. So this got announced quite recently at the time of recording. But it's new, it's £70 million to be invested in different types of MAT growth. So there's a few different strands to the fund, depending on like the size and maturity and historical performance of the trust. But all of those strands are related to encouraging the trust to grow. Most years when we sit down and someone, inevitably our boss asks us, what's going to be the big development in education this year? Someone always says multi-academy trust mergers, like small trusts merging together or like trusts growing and reaching certain sizes. And like it hasn't quite kicked off, like that prediction has never come to light. But like we know from talking to Matt, and the key might be announcing more on this at a later date, excitingly. But you know, trusts want to grow for the right reasons. They don't want to grow for the sake of it. They recognize that you've got to weigh up your financial sustainability versus your capacity to be able to grow, and growing too quickly is what leads to struggling trusts. So like, you know, they have historically not wanted to just rush into growth and take on schools for the sake of taking on schools. But, you know, one of the advantages of trusts and one of the reasons that they look for other schools is a matching ethos and, you know, a vision that will be compatible with the school that's joining and the trust that they are joining. So I think the new fund speaks to the fact that the DfE recognise that trusts need to grow to be financially sustainable. Whether or not that means it's as easy as MATs just growing remains to be seen. But like, I think it's an indication of, the issue of at what point does a trust become financially sustainable? Because there's been like some research into that in the past. I think one report says like it's got to be at a minimum of like it's like 8 to 12 schools is where they start hitting that point. Another looked at in pupil numbers, like anything below 5,000 pupils is not doable. But I mean, that's, these are hard rules of thumb when every mat is different.
It's different, yeah.
Which makes it very unhelpful to talk about mats as an entire sort of subset of the sector. But yeah, no two are alike. But yeah, growth seems to be the sort of hot button issue for them.
The last thing that we had on our radar for the year of year ahead relates to pay.
Yeah.
Actually, the DfE has just announced the school teachers review body has just announced a 2.75% pay uplift for teachers. 0.75% of that will be funded for schools, which means that that's 2% that schools are having to fund from their existing budgets.
I can't see this being a problem.
No,
I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Loads of extra money sloshing around, isn't there? Yeah, it's this 2% is going to hurt. We know just how tight school budgets are, and to have to find an additional 2% is going to be quite a challenge for a lot of schools. And it's a bit, you know, also a little bit of a kick in the teeth that they announced this as most schools were headed off on summer holiday. So poor school business managers are going to be stuck over the summer pulling their hair out over how to make their budgets accommodate this extra 2%, which is just not fair at all. But actually this, you know, in the grand scheme of things, this 2.75% is a small change compared to what the DfE has hinted they would like to see happen in the future. Damien Hines, in his remit letter to the school teachers review body this year, suggested that a further remit would be coming in the new year, where he would ask the STRB to look at the pay system as a whole, and what sort of reforms or changes could be made there. As of yet, that remit hasn't formally landed, so the STRB hasn't actually undertaken any of this work yet, but it would be more involved than simply reviewing pay ranges. We would expect bigger changes there, so we'll probably learn more in the new year when this remit letter lands. There may be some specific details included within it about the types of structural reform that the department wants to see, so we're watching that closely, but that could be a really big change in the future. Not that a 2.75% pay uplift is in any way small, but less structural,
yes,
more fiddling on the margins, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, this is a caveat that underpins basically everything we've talked about, but especially with our speculation for the year ahead. At the time of recording, we found out about an hour ago that Boris Johnson is going to be the new Prime Minister and Tory leader. We don't know what that means for potential Education Secretary going forward.
No, we have
I don't know if he will keep Damien Hines around. We don't know a lot about his plans as of yet. Sort of sod's law that happened whilst we were recording a podcast. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see how that lands. We don't think existing policy implementation is going to get pulled back and immediately sort of like reversed, but things, yeah, like what it means for school funding, that's one of the bigger ticket items that's going to land on the desk of whoever the Education Secretary might be. If it's not, in fact, Damien Hines, he might keep his role. We have no indication either way. We are not clairvoyant, and we would not be working at the Key if we were, much as we like it here.
That feels like a skill that I could probably put to better use elsewhere.
Yeah, hence, by the way, why we've not mentioned Brexit at any point during this podcast, because if we knew what on God's green earth was going to happen there, again, we'd be much higher paid, positions.
That would require the government knowing what was going to happen
there.
Well,
yeah, that's
true. And that's just a bar too high, I think.
But yeah, that's pretty much, we think, or at least that's as much as we can tell you about what we think the year ahead is going to involve. We hope you found it at least somewhat useful or informative. Please do let us know what you think is going to happen.
Thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.